Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And this evening, you will have an insightful program. I'm Joseph Fink, the president of Dominican University and the former chairman of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and more importantly for this evening, your moderator. It's now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco, a noted political commentator, who is here to give us his annual talk on the state of the national and regional politics. Two-term mayor of San Francisco, legendary speaker of the California State Assembly, and widely regarded as the most influential African-American politician of the late 20th century, Willie L. Brown, Jr., has been at the center of California politics, government, and civil life for an astonishing four decades. His career spans the American presidency from Lyndon Johnson to Barack Obama. He's left his mark on just about every aspect of politics and public policy in California. As the mayor of California's most cosmopolitan city, he refurbished and rebuilt the nation's busiest transit system, pioneered the use of bond measures to build affordable housing, created a model juvenile justice system, and paved the way for a second campus of the University of California at San Francisco to serve as an anchor of the new development that is positioning the city as a center for the burgeoning field of biotechnology. Aside from the fact that he has an undergraduate degree from San Francisco State University and a law degree from Hastings College from the University of California, he also has 17, or maybe by now 18, honorary degrees. He also has a soft spot for education, higher education. He's been on the Board of Trustees of the California State University System with 23 campuses and 350,000 students. He's been a regent for the University of California with 10 campuses and 200,000 students. And he's a member of the Board of Trustees of Dominican University with 2 campuses and 2,500 students. So you can see he has a soft spot for higher education. Please join me in welcoming my friend, Mayor Willie Brown.
Dr. Fink, thank you very much for that very kind introduction. I'm amazed that I look out, and I've done this occasion for the Commonwealth Club for several years now, and this is most people I've seen in the room in a long time. I mean, you guys, you have nothing else to do? I know the Giants are not playing tonight. They played in the afternoon, and by the way, Buster Posey is out for the season. And I'm already being asked, does that mean that the Giants are no longer contenders? Of course not. It doesn't mean that. Until we find out we don't have a catcher. But we don't always know what the Giants, what we have or don't have. And that's a good thing, because you always play way over your head when you don't know you're inept. Well, that's part of what that's part of the success of that wonderful team. I am, of course, delighted to be before you again. Things have dramatically changed since last year. I could not have forecast what and who would be in the mayor's seat this time last year, because things were quite different. At that time, Mr. Newsom had just finally figured out where he could win, on what he could win, and therefore the prospect for his replacement, I would not have been projecting so early in the season. But he won the primary on the Democratic side of the aisle, and then he won the job from the incumbent lieutenant governor, and he's now the lieutenant governor. And that opened up a marvelous spot for somebody here in San Francisco. And the somebodies were just an incredible number. And there was just so many somebodies that Mayor Newsom decided that neither one of those somebodies were people he could live with, even though he probably is not going to be living here anymore. But it was clear that he did not feel comfortable with the idea that the people that were asserting themselves, whether it was the president of the Board of Supervisors or whether it was the head of the PUC or whether or not it was the sheriff or whether or not it was any other member of the Board of Supervisors or whether or not it was any ex-mayors who were pounding the halls to try to get the job or ex-members of the Board of Supervisors who were pounding the halls to try to get the job. It was just some of everybody trying to get the job. And Mayor Newsom did the responsible thing. He decided, or in his own wisdom, that he would await the opportunity for the board to let him know whom they would pick. And in this case, it would have to be somebody that satisfied him. And he chose the chief administrative officer for the city and county of San Francisco, Ed Lee. And Ed Lee has proven to date to be a very, very good choice. Ed Lee, in reality, was better qualified than anybody who's ever been in that job from first day. Those of us who won the job won it just as ordinary, regular politicians. And ordinary, regular politicians usually are not qualified for the job that they are, in fact, seeking initially. They have raw talent, all of those kinds of things, but that's a special place. And Ed Lee had been the human rights director for the city and county of San Francisco. Before he was a human rights director, he used to sue the city with some regularity on behalf of the disadvantaged and particularly those who were seeking quality and comfortable housing. He had been a consistent winner of those lawsuits. And so he and the Agnos administration got appointed to do the head the organization that runs the human rights part of our city. As soon as I became mayor, I moved him from there to Purchasing because he was better, in my opinion, at managing the city Purchasing operation, since it always is a source of really a tenderness in that so many people can sell so many things at such an overprice and be, you know, indignant about it when you call it to their attention that you can get it at Ross Dress for Less for a third of the price. And he would do that. And it was, the results were that obviously that office was improved dramatically. And then there was the opportunity, of course, to keep moving him. And the potholes were not being filled quickly enough. And I knew that Ed Lee knew how to fill potholes as well and would do so with a great degree of discipline. And he did so, and I made him head of the Department of Public Works. And that ensured my reelection. And you always sometimes are motivated to do things that has an effect on your reelection. But sometimes they also are good for the city. And this was one of those occasions when it was good for the city. And he did just a marvelous job. All these occasions of his doing these kinds of things meant that he was really carrying out the functions that mayors should carry out and should direct, and he didn't really need any great direction. So it was a good deal. And when colleagues of mine on my staff side concluded that the man holding the job of chief administrative officer had been so reduced in terms of his resources, etc., because I'd been moving them all essentially to me for my own purposes. And they said, you're going to kill yourself. You better find you somebody whom you could really have greater degree of confidence in to do that job. And hence, job became open, and Bill Lee left, and Ed Lee became the new CAO for the city. And he demonstrated those great skills. Mayor Newsom loved every second of his doing those kinds of things, and he learned all aspects of how to run the city, how to deal with all of the personnel of the city, all the things that you would want if you were hiring somebody to be the mayor. And he did that, and he did it with great. And so when Mr. Newsom decided that he would leave, he made sure that Mr. Lee was his replacement, and I think we're all better off for Mr. Newsom having done that. So in the future, when Mr. Newsom's introduced and you point out, you can't point out that he, you know, redid the ferry building or he did the park or he did any of those things. You've got to credit him with doing something I would not have done. I would not have resigned for purposes of letting somebody else have my job. But he did that, and that is really an outstanding thing for him to have done. And it's a significant achievement. And if Mr. Lee sticks around for a full term, it'll be even great. It'll pay even greater dividends. And so we are indeed indebted to Mr. Newsom. And that's just my own personal commercial on that side of. But things have changed dramatically nationwide. When we last were together, and when I gave this occasion for the Commonwealth Club in May of 2010, Barack Obama was unwelcome. I don't know where he was welcome. He didn't have very many invitations, and he was being castigated, and all the Republicans were running against him, and they were taking their toll. Nancy was the speaker and was having trouble keeping the Democrats in place for the Obama programs, but they were moving. And they were moving, but the politics of their movement was obviously for the Democrats' reelectability on the negative side. Obviously, they went through the whole year of 2010 in that category. The Republicans won handsomely in 2010, and at that stage of the game, they were just rubbing their hands together, knowing that Mr. Obama was going to be a one-term president. They really went crazy in the month of November and really celebrated on the theory that somehow it was just a short time before 2011 and 2012 would roll around and they would be able to oust Mr. Obama, put in some Bush-type Republican, and start the bad things happening to this nation all over again. And they were frankly looking forward to that. Well, lo and behold, here we are in May of 2011, just 7 months from those gleeful days. And what do we see? We see Mr. Obama at the height of his popularity, according to the polls that people seem to be able to take. We see Mr. Obama establishing the fact that he was indeed born and actually had a birth certificate. We see Mr. Obama. Being invited to dine in Buckingham Palace. We see Mr. Obama suddenly evidencing the fact that deep down, somewhere near the bottom of his feet, he's also Irish. It's just impressive how Mr. Obama has managed to establish every aspect of what he is and make it attractive and interesting. Simultaneously, however, leading up to these new fabulous invitations, whether they're in Ireland or whether they're in London or whether they're in France, Mr. Obama did what the Republicans have been trying to do since 2001, and that is find bin Laden and do something about it. Well, Mr. Obama put the whole operation together, and obviously his administration, with all of the components in the room that each of us had an occasion to see the photographs of, where Hillary appeared to be bored for a period of time. She put a hand over her mouth. But everybody else seemed relatively attentive. It was an occasion when, in fact, one of the great moments in Mr. Obama's tenure as president was about to take place. They found Mr. bin Laden, and you would think that that finding would have been much earlier. After all, the 6'7" bearded guy walking around with a canister to breathe and one of the best cell phones in the world, you would have think they would have been able to track him much faster. But they did find him. And as the gentleman on the streets, if you read my column, you know there's a gentleman on the streets who walked up to me and said, when you go in that bar and they order a Bin Laden, I said, what is that? When he asked a bartender, he said, it's two shots and a splash. And of course, you have that high watermark coming. And that comes on top of the various things that Mr. Obama had managed to do leading up to that on the substantive side. He had managed to do what Mr. Clinton did prior to the 1996 re-election. Mr. Clinton, after Hillary failed so miserably on the health side, Bill Clinton took the entire playbook that the Republicans had and took all the good features out of that playbook, put it in place and made it his program, and got himself reelected handsomely. Mr. Obama did something similar when he took the entirety Republican playbook between November and January and February and just with regularity took every bit of it. Reneging, in many cases, on promises he had made to Democrats, offending many Democrats in the process of doing that, but establishing himself as a potential nominee on the Republican side of the aisle, if necessary, based upon his incredible performance. And the results were that the Republicans found themselves scrambling. Yet found there were Republicans also who were firmly of the opinion that it was time actually to make money. Sarah Palin, who really was at the moment of the triumph last November in the catbird seat as it relates to the national picture, because everybody had figured out that McCain would not be around by the time 2012 came for sure, and therefore he was not relevant. And they figured that there'd be almost no one else except Sarah Palin. And then, of course, people took a quick assessment of what happened in November to those candidates that Sarah Palin backed, and they discovered that it was a real mixed bag. The results were not as dramatic as Sarah Palin would have wanted them to have been on her behalf. Republican colleagues saw that, and they immediately start looking for somebody else. And in their look, some of the people were finding their own space and time. You have Donald Trump start advertising himself, as he annually does, for some cause that promotes Trump. And he looked at the presidency in that category this time around. So the Republicans begin to scramble. Let's find somebody who can match Obama. But Obama continued to soar, one step after another, obviously reaching crescendos when he took out Bin Laden. And now he's at the top of his game with numbers that are just absolutely fascinating in every sense of the word. He's making major changes in his administration. His entire security operation has been revamped. And suddenly, Leon Panetta, former congressman from down the way, is moving around and suddenly becoming Secretary of Defense. It's just amazing. A transformation has taken place. We're not sure where Hillary's going, but I'm certain that it will be equally as dramatic. Every step that he's taken is reflective, even with the name of the new Joint Chief of Staff, man who heads that operation. All of those are moves that Obama's making that are resonating very well with the public. At the same time, the Republicans are scrambling. They have half a dozen named candidates, none of whom register anywhere on the scale of being able to be totally acceptable. They've got Romney, who runs almost as often as Trump, but not as offensively as Trump. He's there, but he doesn't make any waves whatsoever. And in the presidential sweepstakes, you need to make waves. The Tea Party people, who were at the crest of their game last November, suddenly seem to have lost much of whatever was prompting people to be attracted to Tea Party members. And so consequently, you don't have anybody out there advertising their Tea Party. Palin would love to have been able to say Tea Party, but she found that a little difficult. Paul is back out there running again. He doesn't even say he's Tea Party. Michelle Bachmann, who has been the replacement for Sarah Palin on the electoral side, can't seem to move it yet. Christie out of New Jersey, who would like to be the nominee, but for whatever reason, he's reluctant to step in and try to put it together. And I think it's because he's assessed that, in fact, Obama can and will win re-election handedly, and he doesn't want to be victimized by virtue of that. And then you have a whole host of other people whose names are almost not pronounceable, Pawlenty and others who are considering the possibility of running. And then you have these incredible announcements of people announcing they're not running. So stay tuned. I intend to hold a press conference to announce that I'm not running, and I want just as many people to be enthusiastically moved by virtue of that announcement, because, you know, why would any care whether or not the governor of Mississippi runs? Who, Haley Barber, it's a bad name. Why would you even think in terms of somebody with a name like that being the president? And then, of course, you got the Baptist preacher who finds himself without a church, and therefore he can't run either. And he lost the governorship and the little state that he was in. So just a whole series of things. And then you have some newcomers, some people coming, but they're not running for this time. They're running for years in the future. Huntsman, who now says, no, yes, I was in Utah at one time, but I'm actually from Palo Alto. Did you see that story? It was 7 children, a Mormon in that part of the country, and was proud of it at that time. Obama moved him to the job of ambassador to China, and when he returned, he does not know where Utah is. He bought a house in Washington, D.C., moved back to Washington, D.C., and doesn't want anybody to even think in terms of him being something else. He's now all of a sudden the kind of fresh new face among Republicans, and he's withholding any announcement that he might make. My guess is he probably can't get the nomination anyway. And so Mr. Obama is moving very positively and very aggressively. Some people would say you compare his position to that of Mr. First Bush back in the early 90s, when in fact he was 90% approval. He had just finished Desert Storm, and he was Herbert Walker Bush had just finished this Desert Storm, and he was ready really to move. And lo and behold, he's going to run for re-election. Democrats wouldn't challenge him, he thought. After all, Cuomo was our candidate, and Cuomo reneged on us on the tarmac. We'd already rented the jet. He went out there, and he was standing, and no cancellation notice. Well, we had to pay anyway, and he wouldn't run. And he wouldn't run because the polls showed that Mr. Bush would win re-election. And then Mr. Clinton, who had no job and made application for the presidency, not thinking that, that was really an outside shot, but it became not only an outside shot, it became the standard by which presidents should perform. He won and obviously led this nation in a very handsome fashion. That lesson has not been lost on Mr. Obama. He has taken no chances whatsoever. He is not going to be victimized as Bush was victimized, because what Bush did in the early 90s, in seeking re-election in 92, he decided to go around and just hang out on his achievements. Well, our friend Mr. Obama is not doing that. He's actually moving quickly to make sure that things happen in the Middle East or in the change will happen there. And he's being aggressive about it. Mr. Gaddafi is trying desperately to hang on. But if they keep dropping bombs on every place that he seems to go, he isn't going to have anywhere to go. I can see a whole nation of ex-dictators living all together, and other than in Libya. So that's just, and Mr. Obama is being aggressive about it. You don't think that visit to Buckingham Palace had anything to do with just visiting Buckingham Palace. After all, he should have been offended. I did not read that he got invited to the wedding. He came later, and it's even more impressive because he got a chance to say hello to Kate and to William after they returned from their honeymoon. And so it's obvious that Mr. Obama intends to be incredibly aggressive. He does not intend to sit on his laurels and lose the election. He's out. He's already said, I intend to raise $1 billion for my own reelection. $1 billion. He raised $775 million the first time out of the box, and he did not have the kind of attractiveness that he now has. And he was here most recently, and They called me about 2 days before he got here and said, Mayor Brown, we did not notice your name on the list of people who would be attending. I said, I'm fully aware that my name is not on that list. You, however, must not be looking in you must not have seen my tax return. You would know that I am not in the category of being able to pay $38.5 for a glimpse of the president, no matter how much of an admirer I am of his. And he said, well, we're sorry about that. 5 minutes later, call back. So we want to apologize because the president just saw the list, and he said, Willie Brown is on my list. Willie Brown is invited by me. And so I got invited by the president to come visit with him on his last trip out here, and I really appreciated that because it saved me $38.5. And it gave me bragging rights because I don't know anybody else that got invited that way. Nor do I know anyone else whom in the middle of his speech he referenced me in the middle of his speech, which really pissed off all those people that had paid and remained anonymous. That's part of what you get when you do the kinds of things that I have been doing. On the other hand, San Francisco is having its own issues as it relates to elections. I mentioned at the outset that Ed Lee was the mayor, and I wished he would continue to be the mayor. He's kind of made it clear that that will be a real problem for him. He is not a politician, doesn't want to be a politician, doesn't want to be out there trying to raise money and do all the things that we politicians have to do. Although, it's amazing, he's keeping the same kind of schedule that I kept. And how do I know? Because I'm still keeping that schedule, just in case. An opening presents itself, you always got to be prepared. And so I'm seeing Ed Lee at more places than, and he's frankly the only one that literally among the candidates that are running. I took a look at the list, and I don't know how many of you saw Beta Breakers or read about Beta Breakers or followed Beta Breakers, but the race for mayor in San Francisco looks like Beta Breakers in every respect. The candidates and what have you, we actually need to announce that no drinking in this race, no nudity in the race. We need to, because I'm telling you, we have some of everything trying to become the mayor of this great city. And I would think that there really ought to be at least some standards that you have to meet before you be eligible for candidacy. But San Francisco has lowered the standards. We now are perfectly comfortable on our selection process to make sure mediocrity is the standard. Anybody who exceeds mediocrity is probably not electable. But we really have. We've really ratcheted down. We've ratcheted down by doing several things that I think we need to, as citizens, a group of citizens, consider and change. The first thing that we've done is we've decided that if you want to run for office in San Francisco and re-raise a dollar, you're then eligible for 10 tax dollars or some other similar outrageous figure, and that you can be held accountable for spending that money, but it's your choice as to how you spend it. Now, you know, it's interesting. Yeah, you don't have to buy signs. You don't have to buy time on radio. You don't have to buy ads on television. You don't have to mail anything out. I'm not sure what you do with the money if it isn't those the things that you do, but the money disappears and no one has been prosecuted for misusing it so far, although John Edwards has now made it hazardous to use your money, even the money you claim you don't know about. So the business of funding campaigns in San Francisco is now on the backs of taxpayers. Without that attractive nugget, many people would not be candidates for mayor of San Francisco. So we need to get rid of that public financing. Now, some people say, well, that's the only way you can put a cap on how much people can contribute. In fact, that's partly true. the courts have said that there must be some means by which you, if you're going to stop people from spending money and giving money to politicians without limitations, you've got to have some means by which the public interest is available. Well, let's say, why don't we reverse that? For every $10 we raise, we give you a dollar. That would dissuade a whole lot of people from thinking that they can get their house note by running for public office and use it by renting the space of their house as their campaign headquarters or doing some of the other things that candidates seem to do. So we need to get rid of the whole business of publicly financing campaigns in the handsome way in which we've done. We also need to establish the fact that if you vote and support providing the public finance money, if you're in a position to do so on a board of supervisors or you are the mayor, that's a conflict of interest because you are signing for your own personal benefit ultimately. Now, I know that there's people who interpret that differently, but I'm telling you as a public, we ought to say that just like when I served, we could not receive a salary that we voted upon ourselves unless we got reelected to the office. The salary that I received often would never, ever raised when I was serving until the next term. I could do it and then go back to the voters and explain to them and be eligible. That same concept ought to take place. If you vote to expand the benefits of financing campaigns with public dollars, the campaign you're in should not be one that you could receive the increased numbers from. It should be the next time you run. And therefore, obviously, if you're committed and you really feel that it's principle and you want to do it, then you'll do it for the benefit of the public, not for yourself. We need to remove that provision. We need to impose upon our people exactly that kind of a limitation. We also need to bring them into the world of a real democracy. Now, real democracy obviously says that people who are running for public office must win with a majority vote, and it must be a majority vote that each of us have participated in. Well, I got to tell you, most of us do not participate in the majority vote under what they call ranked choice voting. I'm blown away how comfortable we are to say in ranked choice voting, you get three choices, but you can only use them for three separate and distinct individuals. So wait a minute. There are 42 people running. Ranked choice, I ought to be able to rank all 42 if I choose to. Well, no, we can't count that. We don't have the skills and the ability to count that. In other words, your computer doesn't have the skills and ability to count that. I don't believe that because every time I go to the ATM and try to draw out more than I have in there, that computer won't let me do that. And I think that computer and that software could be used in the same fashion for vote counting purposes. And so we need to change. We need to either say, yes, we have ranked choice and you can rank all 42 choices of people who are running, or you could rank 20 of them, or you can rank 5 of them, or you could just rank 1. It doesn't matter, but all 42 ought to be there. The so-called progressives in this town don't lack that idea. They love the business of being able to put a program together where they look for 1, 2, 3 of the votes and do it in that way and orchestrate it so that in the end they somehow surface as a winner without ever acquiring the majority. That is not the way this democracy ought to be working, and we really ought to address that issue as a collection of people. And then finally, in the process, we should also say that if you're going to run for an office other than the one which you hold, the day you file for that office is the day you have resigned for the office which you hold. You should not be sitting in a position holding an office and running for another office, and if you don't win that other office, you stay in the office you're in. You know what kind of leverage that is? You know what somebody like me could do with that leverage? Every time you'd come before me, I'd inquire as to how you're voting in a very subtle way and let you know the quality of my leadership deserves you promoting me accordingly. So I moved from supervisor to mayor, or from supervisor to sheriff, or from whatever I'm running, I will wish to have your vote. And usually the leverage goes to the person who is in that position. Well, in a democracy, that's not fair. so that you know, when I served as mayor of San Francisco, if I appointed you to a commissionship and you chose to run for public office, I simply accepted your resignation on the day you filed and qualified. Dennis Herrera was the chair of the police commission. He wanted to run for city attorney. I supported him for city attorney, but I also took his resignation at the time that he ran. There was a woman who wanted to run for city attorney, and she had a job working for me. And she came to me and said, I'm going to run for city attorney. And I said, and when you do, the two things you do, you file your papers, and if they're clear and you're qualified, you also file your resignation, because you're not going to keep a job working with me at the city, and you try to leverage. You're head of a department, you'll start leveraging people. Those things contribute to a problem existing in this San Francisco. And then finally, of course, we have the horror of the so-called representation by districts. San Francisco is a very small city. Sean Ellsberg, out in the area called, I suppose, Stonestown, that part of the city, Park Merced, all out there, that's what he represents. He should be as interested in what happens on the waterfront in San Francisco as he is in what happens on SF State's campus. Only way he can be that interested is that the people on the waterfront in San Francisco can have some effect on whether or not he can keep his job. The same goes for someone living in Seacliff. They should be concerned about what happens in Hunters Point. Somebody living in Chinatown ought to be concerned about what happens out in Ocean View. And the only way that ever happens is, in fact, there's a universality in this very small city, i.e., in other words, you run citywide and you get elected citywide and you get elected with more than 5,000 votes. At one time in this town, you could lose an election with 85 or 90,000 votes having been cast on your behalf. Now you become you could be elected president if we had a president in this town with 84 or 95,000 votes. That's how incredibly different it has become for voters by virtue of how we've changed that. And in that process, in my opinion, we've lowered the bar so that, in fact, people who really have a universal perspective, who really are interested in every aspect of the city, who really would like to see this city flourish, they are, in fact, restricted and limited because they have to tailor themselves to reflect the so-called narrowness of a small, encrusted group of people in one little district of 60 or 65,000 people. And when the votes are cast, it's usually no more than 8 to 10,000 people that have elected you to participate as one of the members of 11 members of the Board of Supervisors and govern a city of 780,000 people. That's disproportionate representation caused by an insignificant number. That needs to be changed. And if we are to ultimately, in my opinion, save the city, these are some of the things that we need to consider and we need to so address. If not, my guess is that it will not be long before things lack the problems with reference to pensions, things lack all of the other things that each of us know about and concerned about, particularly surrounding the budget, will be really hard-pressed to be able to find quality people to answer the bell when the bell rings on those problems. The state of California clearly reflects exactly what I've just described to you. Over the years, there has been a continuation of the business of deferment, excessive movement in terms of providing programs without understanding the nature of the financing of those programs and with a lack of an understanding about the whole business of evaluating cost and the projections of cost, and it has resulted, as with term limits, placing a limitation on the talent who could go there and address those issues. The state of California is in bad shape. San Francisco may end up being the same way if we, as a group of citizens, do not begin to address the issues more aggressively and with a greater level of principles and understanding as a whole city than we currently do today. I see that there's 30 minutes. You want questions. And by the way, I have to work tonight because, you see, I do a column. And in that column, I review movies. I review bartenders. I review chicken. I review all kinds of things that occurs in this city. and I'm tagged already. Of course, I have been so occupied all week with other kinds of activities, I haven't done a movie. And I got to get this column done by Sunday. So I'm on my way to see Hangover 2 after I leave here in order to be able to write about it and to tell you whether or not you should see it. I hope you've been very studious and reading the column and you've only seen the movies that I've recommended. With that, I conclude the formal part of this, and now the good part is question and answer. And, you know, you're an amazing collection of people. Obviously, some of you wrote them damn questions at home because you couldn't have delivered them that quickly to him. And I saw you walking up here just as I stepped up. You came up with some questions. Throw those in the trash can. Let's get the people who are current.
Thank you. Yeah, go ahead. Our thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and the speaker of the California Assembly, and a noted political commentator for his comments this evening. It's now time to turn to the question and answer period, and we have a number of questions for you, Mr. Mayor. I was kind of ambushed when I was walking in and handed this question. I promised to ask it.
I told you. There was people who brought those questions from home. Ordinarily, those kind of questions I charge for answering.
This is a very, very long list of positive statements about Dennis Herrera, but it finishes with the question, Mr. Mayor, what do you think of Dennis Herrera?
What do I think of Dennis Herrera?
And his chances as far as becoming mayor.
Well, I made it very clear that I think Dennis Herrera ought to support Ed Lee.
All right, well, now you've had your question answered. Let me ask a couple more questions regarding San Francisco, San Francisco itself. If you were mayor today, what would you be doing about reinventing the mid-market community of San Francisco?
I would do some of the things that Mayor Lee and the Board of Supervisors are currently doing. The business of inviting the world of social networking to make that corridor their headquarters is one of the things that could drastically change. The business of trying to get the cultural complexes of San Francisco to focus some of their attention on that section of the city by putting in some additional theater training facilities, rehearsal halls, and all the other things that go with it. And in addition thereto, I would take private-driven automobiles off of Market Street from about 10th Street down to all the way down to the waterfront. I would leave Market Street for traffic purposes open to buses, to town cars, to taxicabs, to limos. But private-driven automobiles would be off Market Street, and you could only stop in bus zones and only for a few minutes. I'd turn that into a space and a place where you would enjoy yourself walking and riding bicycles and doing the things that people do. I would also encourage and use the ability to finance things like we did in the Mission. And the Mission, it is not by accident that the Mission has become a place where we actually go to dine at night. If we could figure out where to park, we would go there more often. But there's nowhere to park in the Mission because we still have this crazy business about no parking in the city. We financed foreign cinema. We financed two or three other places down there with public money, and it's been paid back just as we've done in other parts of the city. I would commence to do that in the mid-market area to encourage folk who really wanted to do investing in the city. I'd partner up with them and give them the same leverage. I'd also have my planning department become a bit more aggressive at selecting for their review purposes projects that are sited in the mid-market and thereby have a faster acceleration for mid-market projects on a priority basis. That's what I would do.
Okay, thank you. One additional issue concerning San Francisco, and that has to do with its fiscal condition. Can San Francisco survive its budget crisis without making significant changes in the pension systems that we've developed with the unions of public employees in the city?
Well, you got to understand that all across America, public employee retirement benefits have created a higher cost factor in general fund expenditures than was originally envisioned, if envisioned at all. In some places, total and complete collapse of the economy and the operation of a given city is the only thing that has effectively offered an opportunity to change that, because the vesting component of a retirement system ties your hands in zero flexibility. Mayor Lee just had that happen when he made his announcement 2 or 3 days ago, and it was such a modest amount that Jeff Hodachi, who had kind of been the catalyst in previous years, raised questions about whether or not that was sincere. It was, of course, sincere, because the business of vested benefits is something that can't be addressed effectively at all, even if you really wanted to. Going forward, yes, but you can't go backwards. Only time you get a chance to go backwards is when you become like Vallejo. You go essentially bankrupt, and everything, you can pay nobody, and that nobody includes the retired people. If San Francisco gets to that stage, then there will be some dramatic changes in the nature of the retirement system. If not, going forward, we really are going to have to address. Because you see, the private sector on the retirement side is amazing. You don't hear anything about the private sector having retirement problems, because the nature of the policies and the programs that are put together in the private sector are designed to flow with the ability to pay. We on the public side have always been of the opinion that our employees were so valuable, we really protected them in every way. And the one thing you could be assured of, you may not be paid comparable wages while you're working the day, but when you finally retire after your dedicated years of service, you are going to be handsomely rewarded by being almost equal in your retirement benefits to somebody who's been in the private sector. We never, ever figured that we would be in a place where, in many cases, the salaries of public employees exceed the salaries, the comparable salaries and wages paid to private sector people. The benefits, obviously, on the public side are much greater. Those issues are going to have to be honestly and objectively addressed. Otherwise, at some stage, most jurisdictions are going to find themselves in the Vallejo situation, and when they do, it'll be total and complete disaster, because after all, I'm a retiree.
Thank you very much. You you didn't spend a great deal of time in your talk on the state of California and what was going on. What grade would you give Jerry Brown thus far on his performance as governor?
Incomplete.
Would you mind explaining why?
Well, simply because the budget isn't done yet. There has not yet been any addressing of many of the issues. Jerry has been so occupied with the budget in that process that there are an enormous number of vacancies or holdovers from the previous administration trying to run state government, so he hasn't been able to get through all of the vetting process to fill those respective positions. It would be unfair to even grade him at this stage of the game, because all you could do is give him an incomplete. You wouldn't want to flunk him. He's too talented to do that. He has too much potential, frankly, and there is such a great need. All that talent, in my opinion, will ultimately begin to pay dividends as soon as he gets this budget out of the way, because I can see Jerry overnight fill in one vacancy after another. He did those kinds of things from 74 to 82, and it left the state in really great shape. the bench that is currently in the process of retiring, in most cases, was put in place by Jerry Brown. And they were quality people holding those respective positions. He'll get back to doing that. But at this moment, because of term limits, because of an absence of talent in both houses, because of that same standard that I say is applicable in San Francisco, it's applicable in Sacramento, because that's what we, the voters, want. We don't really want outstanding people holding office. We want people who will make us feel better, because we know we're better than they are at every level. And therefore, we stymie government in the process. And Jerry is plagued with that kind of talent in both houses, absence thereof. And until that kind of talent grows up a little bit more, politically speaking, he is going to have that kind of trouble. But he's got the wherewithal, and he's got a great collection of folk that he has, and they're all women, strangely enough. He's got his wife. He's got Nancy McFadden. He's got the woman that heads the Department of Finance. He's got the woman that heads the appointment process. All of his people are women, and believe me, it will not be long, in my opinion, before that incomplete becomes, well, I suspect he'll drop some of the items, withdraw some of the items like I used to do in college. But I think the ones that he keeps, he will pass with outstanding marks.
Okay. Thank you. What's your evaluation of his possibility of getting his ballot measure through regarding taxation?
I think he's already signaled that he would hope that that vote would be taken at some point, but he's not insistent that it has to be in his lifetime. And that pretty much says to me that he's going to be comfortable making the deal without that vote.
All right, thank you. There's been a good deal of news recently about the most recent former governor of California. And you you made a comment in your column recently regarding Arnold Schwarzenegger to basically the effect that he was a human being who made mistakes and is probably started that relationship when he was a Hollywood star as opposed to the governor of California. What's the reaction been to that column?
Oh, my God. It's frankly been amazing. I love being recognized on the streets, but this week I disguised myself. I actually walked around as if I was white. A lot of people, think. As a matter of fact, most people, not a lot of people, most people think that, he really ought to be punished beyond any redemption period. I don't frankly have that attitude because I know that that's a reality that we all are part of in this world, and there are so many things that I suspect each of us have had an occasion to do. We prefer to have nobody know about them. We really would prefer to have our wife and children not know about them. And I think that Arnold was in that category. He must have lived over the last 12 or 13 years every day with the prospect that, as my friend Charlotte Schultz is prone to say, the next shoe will fall. He must have lived every day of his life wondering about that. Can you imagine just before you go to sleep, did they find out? It really must have been just awful. And now that they have found out, it appears as even more awful. Because not only is he now suffering, but his family is suffering. And I wouldn't wish that on anybody in anybody's family. Yes, of course, he conducted himself in the way in which he conducted himself. And yes, you could say that he should have projected that this might happen and that the world would find out about it. I would think that we all would have the same view if we were situated in such a way that we'd done something. Why would I want the world to know about something that I may have done? I would spend all my life trying to redeem without telling you why I'm trying to redeem. And hopefully, when me and the Lord have our little conversation, he will tell me whether or not I made it. And I suspect that Arnold had anticipated having that conversation with the Lord. Now it's over. The Lord's been told what he did. Arnold's not going to have all that much time to straighten it out, but I think he's going to try.
Thank you. Let's continue that for a little bit. Not about Arnold so much, but about the fact that in the United States, a political leader's personal life seems to be public fodder, basically because, or at least it's claimed, basically because of the fact that a personal life is reflective of an individual's character. In Europe, it seems to be so much the opposite, where the personal life of the individual doesn't matter, and what really matters is the public life and leadership of those individuals who are political statesmen. Why do you think America has moved in such a different direction than Europe?
Well, I suspect, of course, we've had so many incompetent scoundrels trying to be elected officials. In the electoral quality of other countries doesn't exactly marry ours. There is a dramatic difference. The parties seem to have passion for whatever their causes might be, and people participate in that way, and they reflect themselves accordingly. They don't measure character by interpersonal relationships unless it has something to do with corruption, unless it has something to do with nepotism, unless it has something to do with exploitation of some sort. And I don't argue about the whole business of how we are as elected officials looked at in this country. Dr. Joe, I don't think that's ever going to change. It's unfortunate because we oftentimes elect people who allegedly are of better character. No mind, no commitment, no performance, but allegedly better character because they have a dog and two children. And they go to church and they help plant trees, do little things like that. They don't know a damn thing about taking care of poor people. They don't know anything about taking care of disadvantaged people, physically disabled people. They don't know anything about taking care of universal programs in the world of education. But just as long as they go to church stay with the same person, woman stays with the same man all of her life, even though from 2 days after the marriage she knew it was a bad deal. But we require them to stick in there, and we give them high marks, unfortunately, for that. And I don't really think that's going to change. So I don't want to spend any time trying to adjust that. I will just keep trying not to get caught.
Thank you. For those of you in the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. And our guest is Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco and political commentator, who's discussing the political arena in 2011. Let's go to the national level. President Obama has been attacked by liberals in his own party for abandoning his principles Is he going to lose his base, and what impact is that going to have on his election in 2012?
He has had some trouble with the leadership on that side. He has not had any trouble with the base. The base is as solid today for Obama, if not more solid, than it was 3 years ago when he was first a candidate. And it's solid because there is a great belief in Obama. There's a belief that he doesn't lie to you. There's a belief that he's not exactly skilled at spinning it. There's a belief that he's really trying hard and he makes tough decisions. And there's a belief that he believes in this democracy to the extent that he understands that you build a consensus for a conclusion rather than simply win the day with your own personal view. The base understands that. Some parts of the leadership will have some trouble with that, and they will keep having trouble with that. But that might endear him more to the base of the American people, and that's why I said early on, kiddingly, that he could probably get the Republican nomination, simply because he is reflective of what people think you ought to be in a true democracy.
Thank you. You've been very, very... you praised President Obama a great deal during this talk, and but in our recent history, no American president who's had an unemployment rate of over 8 or 8.5% has been reelected as president of the United States. What do you think is going to happen with that employment rate, and would he be able to overcome that high unemployment and still be reelected?
I think he will be able to overcome high unemployment rates. I believe, however, those rates will not be as high as they are today. I think the economy is improving, although the guy that manages my little 401 calls me every Thursday to report. And he called me today to tell me that my 401 in the last 4 or 5 days has gone down by $3,000 or $4,000. I'm in total panic because that means it's half of what it was worth before. But I don't think that's going to be the case next November. I think by the time the election really begins to unfold and things really begin to cook in the year of 2012, when the election is actually going to be conducted, the economy will have dramatically improved worldwide. There will be greater level of peace. We will have ended the war in Afghanistan. We won't be at war with the Pakistanis. We won't waste any more time in Iran. We will have completed the mission in Libya, in Yemen, and Syria, and all the other places that we're currently being attentive to will have gone in a different direction. And Barack Obama will have greater domestic resources available to address the issues. And the public will be more engaged. And in spite of the fact that it's very difficult to find a job for many of us, we won't hold that against him.
All right, thank you. One more question about national politics. It has to do with the fact that if the Democrats regain the House of Representatives in 2012. Do you believe Nancy Pelosi will become the Speaker again, or has she become such a lightning rod for the venom of the Republican Party that she would be ineffective?
The Democrats cannot win the House in 2012 without Nancy Pelosi orchestrating that win. Nancy Pelosi is the one that orchestrated the change in Democratic fortunes in this nation, starting in 2002, and by 2006, she had really turned the Republicans out of Washington. They contribute substantially to that by their ineptness. This guy Paul Ryan and the kind of things he's suggesting has scared every old-timer in this country. I am now no longer allow them to direct deposit my Social Security check. I get it, and I run down there and draw that money out right away for fear that with Ryan around, it might disappear. And so I think Nancy is going to be the orchestrator of the campaigns and the fundraising that will win the House back, and they will richly reward her with her second tenure as Speaker of the House.
Thank you. Unfortunately, we have time for just one last question, and there actually only is one that you haven't covered, and I haven't actually read this carefully, but it's in a...
And don't...
It's in a very feminine handwriting. It's actually numerous questions. How many hats do you have, Mayor Brown? And may I buy you a new one? And what is your hat size? And is a man's hat size related? I'm sorry, I can't read the rest of that. But would you care for a new hat anyway?
Those are all very personal questions. And no, the hat size doesn't have anything to do with any other size. I don't think. But I have a few hats. I'm never bothered to count them. I'm now in the process of allowing people to bid on them. You know, they're still after me to give something for charity to bid and silent auction and all that business. And so I'm now beginning, and they're beginning to request hats. And I'm beginning to give up a hat here and there. And so my hat group is going down. And then I got this lady friend of mine who now is wearing hats, and not buying hats. She's wearing hats, and the hats she's wearing are mostly mine. And so, and she's kind of funny in that regard. If she wears it three times, she considers it as a transfer of ownership. So I'm having some trouble being able to answer the question, but I will certainly discuss it with you after the meeting.
All right, our thanks to Willie Brown. Thanks to Willie Brown, the former mayor of San Francisco. We also wish to thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Joseph Fink, the president of Dominican University, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.